Thanks, Rob. This is Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200, the number. We reload this week's news. Very excited to do so. Do we like what's the biggest story? What's the overreported, underreported, winners, losers? Which story are we going to remember in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from now? I think it's going to be the new Bears quarterback. That's what I think.
You think so, huh?
I think that kid is going to come on the scene in like 100 years and be like, remember Trubisky.
500 years, for
and
sure.
And we'll call him Trubinsky. We won't call him Trubisky because that's a Chicago way, right? That's it.
Wait, are we going to remember his prowess on the field?
Yeah.
Or
you
think
so.
That's what it's going to be?
I hope it's all stats and touchdowns. That's what you hope.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But yeah, there could be other things,
maybe
too.
I'm kind of hoping for a new Super Bowl shuffle. Like just whoever does that is, I'll be honest, my primary interest in football is
only,
just that.
Yeah, the only team that could do that would be the Bears. They would not let anybody else do that. But if the Bears got good again, they could do a remount of the shuffle and everyone would love it.
That's what I'm aiming for.
Amanda Vinicky from political reporter at WTTW. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Eitan McKaylee, of course, the longtime housing reporter and also the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America from the Age of the Pullman Porters to the Age of Obama. Also a Midland Award winner, just found out.
Midland Author Society, the prestigious 100-plus-year-old organization, Saul Bellow, Alex Kotlowitz. As I say these names, I'm really daunted by getting.
Well, congratulations, man. It's well deserved. We talked about the book when it came out, and congratulations, and thanks for being back with us tonight to talk about the week that was. Why don't we start with you, Eitan? We talked about the biggest stories of the week. What do you have for the biggest story of the week?
Well, I went international, and I thought that the election in France this week, which was the first round of the presidential election in France, which went to broke down to started with a lot of candidates, four major ones, and broke down to two. So we're now down to Marine Le Pen, who is an ultra right wing nationalist,
more your Donald Trump fare, right?
And the daughter of someone even more Trumpian than Trump himself, I would say, and
maybe more Bannon than Bannon, right? I don't know who's just like Trump, truly.
It's scary in every conceivable way.
I'm not
way.
Going there, but yeah.
And this new guy who's, you know, not even 40 years old and is totally untested and undefined, but has declared himself to be a globalist. So it's the nationalists versus the globalists. And I think that this is the moment, you know, that we'll see whether this kind of wave of nationalist global nationalism.
Well, there's been a real push to sort of focus on what's happening in, of course, in the UK, but also in France and other parts of Europe to see if there is a global change in the way that we think of politics or who's running for politics or who's winning these elections. So it is interesting. France is sort of the first sort of look at this. But yeah, at the same time, I had that as one of my rabbit hole stories because I read the story about his wife. Did you read this story? The guy's wife is almost double his age.
Oh, I did hear about this. Yes.
It's really interesting. Like she comes from a big family, a rich family in France, and he's in his rise to power, he's kept it quiet. They don't make appearances. They don't do whatever. But she was actually his school teacher when he was in high school.
And apparently, it's already the plot of the alt in the alt right to put out rumors about Macron and his wife's daughter.
So they've
already
see that.
That's already a thread on 4chan. I'm told. I don't frequent 4chan.
Anyway, I can now you can probably understand why he's kept it quiet, right?
Yeah.
Amanda, what do you
I'm
got?
I'm burying my head right now at the thought of that.
I guess the things
that do or don't matter when you're running for office. I don't know if you're running on an ethics platform. Sure, I suppose it should. I feel like France is different, though.
But
right?
that's what I took from this article.
Norms, yeah.
I took it from the article that the big takeaway was it didn't matter in France. France has a different if you were having that as someone running for office in America, it would be like, oh, but in France, they're like, we don't care, this is fine. Like, that
right.
was the thing. So
I took French in high school. I wish I could say I'm more familiar with French culture and spent a lot of time in Paris, but alas, Paris, Illinois, a couple times.
Amanda, what do you got for biggest story of the week?
You know, this might go into the realm of overreported, and so I'm not sure it's actually the biggest, but I feel like all that I heard this week was 100 days of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I suppose why I will go with that is I have enjoyed, whereas that's perhaps a unnecessary trope. I mean, who cares? It's 100 days. What exactly does that measure? It's a false, nice round number that we can pick out and who really gives, except for every president goes through it. And it has been interesting to really hear on all the various platforms. I think it takes away a bit of the breathlessness of the Trump coverage and has instead been a little bit deeper and retrospective. So I've actually enjoyed that. It's kind of how, you know, reporting on a president should be.
It's
versus,
more reflective than sort of immediate, right?
Yeah. And so I think that that's important. And it has delved, therefore, into what is going on in France and Brexit and North Korea. And so I guess I'm also kind of cheating with that as an answer because that involves everything.
It involves everything. I'm very interested in that story as well, only because you've heard the president say, it doesn't matter. This is the media making this up. But whoever's asking, it's the best ever.
Look, and
it's sort of like the strangeness of it. But go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's got to be said that his supporters think that he's done a lot in that 100 days, and you know I'm not in that category of people that think he's accomplished a lot. But I have to acknowledge a couple of things that have been done. Right, the Supreme Court justice is installed. I'm going to be hard pressed to think of other like really concrete ones.
Well, I guess there's a big schism when it comes to the idea of what's been accomplished and what's been introduced, because Donald Trump has introduced with executive orders. He has tried to roll back, review, change a lot of different issues. I mean, everything from immigration to even as we just saw in the last couple of days, tax reform. So, if you look at it, say he's taken on a lot, but then the critics will say, well, what has he accomplished? A lot of these things are hanging around. They're there, or they've been already sort of struck down by courts. So what is the measure of 100 days?
I mean, if you look at the goal, if the goal is to make the United States a more insular, less globalized culture, then that's already been accomplished. The immigration bans, even though they've been struck down by the courts, are still sending...
It has an effect.
That's right. It has a clear message to people around the world. You see immigration numbers going down. Illegal immigration has been going down for quite some time under a regime in which even President Obama was deporting large numbers of people. And this is, I think we have to look at this for a second, because we maybe do have a problem in terms of lining up the number of immigrants with sectors of the economy where we need them for the workforce. But I think it's really clear that deporting people is not the way to solve that problem. It was a way for the president to create President Obama to create pressure on Congress, perhaps to pass something when it comes to immigration. President Trump has embraced deportation as some sort of savory way to change the culture again of the United States. But the reality is it's not solving the problem when it comes to the workforce. That's not how deportation is going to work.
Well, it's interesting, and you know, it has been a very, very active 100 days. I'll give the president that. Eitan McKaley, Amanda Vinicky in studio. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and let's start tonight. We'll start it off. We'll go right to overreported and underreported. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Stay with us. Reloading this week's news on a download here on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. Eitan McKaley, the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. Also Amanda Vinicky, the political reporter at WTTW. You can find them Chicago Tonight and all the great programming over there. All right, so let's talk about overreported. We'll probably get to overreported. We'll do underreported after the break because there's a lot when overreported. Eitan, you stick with the international theme. You say North Korea.
I had North Korea as either underreported or overreported. We don't really know, right? If there's, you know, a nuclear war in the next couple of days, then we'll say that it was underreported and it was like, you know, Sarajevo in 1914. Oh, it was just a gunshot. You know, just the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. What's the big deal?
What's the big deal? Overreported.
Yeah. So that could. But on the other hand, if it's just bluster, if they just bust in all 100 senators in a colossal waste of time, bust all 100 senators to the White House for a meeting about North Korea, which seemed to be about very little. One senator reported that it was stuff that you could have read about in the newspaper. So if that was the case, then it's grossly overreported because it's
it also as you start to break that, because I had North Korea as well as a rabbit hole story, you know, finding out more about that story. I mean, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling come on here on Mondays and they talk about Seoul is 40 miles from the border. I mean, they have missiles. So there's not. Now you start to understand a little bit more. And I blame myself for my ignorance of not paying attention to the North Korea standoffs of the past. But understanding why it's not as easy just to go in there and carpet bomb a country. Mm-mm. They're ready to strike, and they can hurt a lot of people
really
quick. American
military bases with thousands of American citizens, families, children, and extended families
are close as Downers Grove.
They're close in Korea and in Japan as well, in the middle of population centers that are well within North Korea's nuclear striking range right now, not to mention
the geopolitics of China. I mean, there's so much that is wrapped up in that.
And you want, and I guess it's overreported, this idea that this almost like John Wayne, I'm going to change the way that American policy has been done for 20, 30 years, as we see with Donald Trump. And it's a little scary because there has been some pretty thoughtful leaders on both sides of the aisle that have had worn kid gloves when dealing with this situation. So you don't necessarily like to see, well, I'm just going to bring my aircraft carrier to your beach.
Right? And I mean, I'm not a federal government reporter, but from what you hear about the Foreign Service Office, that's severely depleted right now. You've had many a resignation, a lot of experience out the door, and there, I believe, isn't a deputy there to even communicate really with the Foreign Service officers. So you're sort of starting at this very major point when we're down in the quote-unquote soldiers of foreign relations.
And on the other hand, I mean, I will say it too. I mean, it hasn't worked. We're still in a situation where they're testing nuclear missiles. So the question is, you know, do you have to change your policy?
Will anything work?
Yeah, will anything
work? I mean, I don't know. Let's question how much can America or anybody control when you have very wild dictators that are half the globe away.
I mean, well, what do you do when you have like a regime that's really primarily interested in its own survival and enrichment? They're just a bunch of gangsters, you know, holding their own people hostage. There's no way that you can really bargain with them, because any reasonable solution would mean that the Kim family is no longer in power in North Korea, and that's the one thing that they're not willing to trade away. So you're in
for a reason out the window, basically.
Yeah.
I will say this, as today another test, a missile test for North Korea right in the face of the Trump administration, but failed, as they mostly do. You just wonder about, and Dave brought this up in Touche as well, about our cyber capabilities and how much we're probably messing with their missiles. I mean, so for as much as that has been, you know, much maligned, our intelligence and our defense when it comes to cybersecurity and cyber attacks, we seem to be doing a good job when it comes to missiles. So we'll take that.
Well, North Korea knows that they would not survive any kind of armed encounter with the United States. That's not what they are threatening us with. They're threatening us with exactly what Amanda was talking about, the destruction to the region, the disruption to the global economy. That kind of stuff is really all that they have that keeps them in power. And again, if your goal is just to stay in power in that kind of narrow way, well, that's going to be the calculation.
Eitan McKaylee, Amanda Vinicky in studio tonight. Let's take a quick break and we'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll continue with overreported and underreported. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. If you've got a choice for winners, losers, that's coming up next. We're still on overreported and underreported, but we'll get to all the stuff tonight here as we reload the news with Amanda Vinicky, political reporter, Chicago Tonight, WTTW. Also, Eitan McKaylee, the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America from the Age of the Pullman Porters to the Age of Obama. All right, so let's get into underreported. We talked about overreported, underreported. Amanda, this is right into your area of expertise. This really has to do with Springfield. A story about patronage.
Yeah, Governor, former Governor Pat Quinn, is coming out now. There was word years ago about all sorts of what seemed to be illegal hires under the Illinois Department of Transportation. And now we do have a report from Nicole Brennan. She is basically this court inspector that is looking into all of it. And what came out really is appalling. And I think it didn't gain a lot of traction for obvious reasons. I mean,
a lot going on, right?
Well, a lot going on, but also he's former Governor Pat Quinn. And though he was very much, I think it seemed for a while, flirting with trying to throw his name in the ring for Democratic candidate nomination for governor yet again, that didn't come to fruition, I think, in part because of this. And I guess to me, it is twofold. Number one, his legacy. He had very much tried to be the guy who painted himself as ethical, above board,
right,
the good guy.
Opposite,
and people
kind of
gave,
right,
him that.
Right.
You know, right, exactly. The opposite of, he may be bumbling, he may not be as effective, but he's a good guy who's on the up and up. And
he mows his lawn with a hand lawnmower.
Right. That commercial. Oh, and I could see that. I do think he is cheap. But this story, I think, gets to the heart of what frustrates people about Illinois politics, what should anger people, one of the many things that should bother them about how government is run. And that is basically you had a whole lot of lawmakers, other connected individuals using their connection to Pat Quinn. And part of it is, I mean, horse trading. That's how it goes. You're the governor. You want a deal. You want them to vote for something. But not when taxpayers need to pay.
So essentially
pay
what
these
he
salaries.
Did, what he did was, yeah, he said, he horse traded by saying, I can get your person a job. I'll put your person in the eye.
We don't know if he necessarily made that or if maybe they just made the ask and he acquiesced. We're not quite sure how it unfolded.
Sort of political patronage hires in the Illinois Department of Transportation. Eitan, come on. That's like straight out of. That's the Shachtman decree. That's everything Chicago is known for that Democrats have tried to move away from.
It's the worst in ways that keep on causing problems for taxpayers also, because it's also putting unqualified people in jobs that they'll have for decades and then pensions that they'll have for additional decades. And you can be sure that those same people will find ways to game their pensions such that they get into six-figure territory. That's really...
And what you said in terms of how it's hard to get rid of, because when you are somebody that is in a position that is supposed to be political, of course, you know, you're the governor, you need people that you trust that don't necessarily belong to a union or meet certain criteria. You can choose whoever you want to be in your inner circle. That is allowed under Illinois law. What happened here, however, was that jobs that were supposed to be based on merit, that everybody who applied was going to be on equal ground, instead were given to people that didn't have the appropriate resume. Sometimes it appears didn't even turn in a resume.
They gave it to Uncle Jim.
They just had a name.
Right. Yeah.
And
right.
So those people, though, if you're in, for example, a union job and you get one of these jobs, then they're protected. So you can't get rid of them, even if they stink at what they're supposed to be doing for the taxpayer.
As you said, that's right, because Rauner, you know, there's some thought about what happened with the comptroller's office, Leslie Munger's office, that they lost. A lot of the people from that office went to Rauner's inner circle. But the question being, if Rauner is out of office, they go too.
Exactly.
But
that
in this
is,
case,
that
these
is the big difference.
Right.
I do think that Rauner, when you have Illinois, of course, in this budget situation, we're at 667 days now without a budget. When you are the governor that is overseeing that, it is fair to raise questions. Why do we need former comptroller Leslie Munger, let alone at $80,000. Why do we need all of these individuals? Maybe a couple of them, it was a big hire at a time that Illinois clearly doesn't have money. And the governor just this week was testifying during a hearing, hey, our office spending is down 10%. Well, yeah, it might be, but you can also filter that into other departments. That's hard to figure out. Either way, when you're overseeing this budget calamity, that is a big ask. But that is a very different thing than what happened here with former Governor Quinn.
How much, I mean, this is red meat for Rauner's base. Republicans have always called out Democrats for this kind of patronage hiring. We see it in Chicago. This is what they, when you see Fox News say the Chicago way, they talk about Obama. That's the heart and soul of it. I mean, that will be something that Bruce Rauner will run on for reelection.
the Democrats are vulnerable there. That's where Rauner will hang Mike Madigan on any Democratic candidate, whether it's J.B. Pritzker or Daniel Biss or someone else. You're as a Democrat, you're vulnerable to that because the Democratic Party has, as Amanda said very well, engaged in exactly this kind of politics for decades and decades. The Republicans certainly haven't been immune to it either, but...
They just haven't been in control.
They haven't been in control, right.
If they were in control, we'd see. But okay, so let's talk
maybe,
about
although that is not something, I mean, Rauner has done a lot and who knows what will come out, but this is not something that he has particularly been, you know, privy to doing, at least that we've seen. He doesn't need to.
He doesn't owe anybody either. He self-financed his campaign and feels like, you know, he can continue to do that. So he doesn't have these power brokers that he's beholden to. You could say that that's an argument for self-financing campaigns, but of course there are other problems there in that someone comes in with an agenda that is wacky and not necessarily connected to things that actually make sense to average people.
It's interesting. I actually was at a panel and somebody was bemoaning that the governor doesn't have anybody that he's held accountable to because he isn't taking a salary. He calls himself a volunteer. That is true. He doesn't need this job. The governor says that that is a good thing. He portrays that as evidence that he is just doing this because he loves the state and is trying to do its best for it. And also that he doesn't have to, you know, kiss up to any of these political figures. He doesn't have a Madigan King. That said, he has become the boss very clearly. So you can criticize all you want when it's others, but that is very much who he now is.
Okay, let me ask you that, because there's been two instances now that have been very interesting that have started to develop a persona for Governor Rauner. One being the conservative Republicans in the state, whether it be in the Senate or whether it be the lobbying interests, whatever it is, you've seen them in two different occasions, one with the grand bargain, step in and say, if you pass these bills, we will not support you, money-wise, votes, what have you. And he acquiesced. He said, get out. Secondly, the abortion bill this week. You saw Governor Rauner with pressure from conservatives saying, if you do not publicly say veto this, you will not have our support. So for as much as he's on his own and he's got his own interests and there's not, he seems to be kowtowing a little bit to the conservative interests of the state.
Money only gets you so far. And you know, in terms of the grand bargain and what killed it, there very much was this outside pressure from conservatives. And it has been fascinating because some of those groups were those that Rauner has given money to. And it does raise a lot of questions about who's in charge, who's calling the shots, and why. And I don't think that there are any clear answers to that just yet. Was it that he was kowtowing? Was it that the governor didn't really like the grand bargain? I would venture that it's probably a mixture of both. And of course, that grand bargain deal, Rauner still maintains he actually wasn't the one who killed it. Then he says it's close, but clearly there hasn't really been any action on that. So that's a whole other ball of wax in terms of, it seems to be talking out of both sides of his mouth, frankly. But in terms of the abortion debate, yes. I mean, they made that threat, and Rauner very much needs his base right now. I think for a while he was counting in his first time around, made a lot of efforts in the suburbs and to gain votes there, particularly with women. But at this point in time, with particularly the budget impasse, no, his base has to be Republicans.
Amanda, politics is hard. State politics are hard. And one of the masters of it, and he gets so much flack for it, is Speaker Madigan. The idea of an abortion bill, a bill
brilliant.
I mean, it's brilliant in the way that it really doesn't do anything to change what we have on the books right now. What it does is it puts Governor Rauner in a position to make a position, which is what they want for a 2018 reelection campaign. Now the pro-choice governor is out the window. He doesn't have the support of moderate voters. They're going to flash this up in front of us, and when it comes to campaign commercials and everything, they got the governor to move off of that hybrid platform where he was a pro-choice Republican. Now, I mean,
but he was not necessarily out there. He just kind of tried to ignore any sort of social
issue. He said, I'm not dealing
with
social issues. I'm a finance guy.
This forced him to take a position on that. And it is something, so that abortion bill, it would have some effect. For example, it would allow Medicaid recipients to have an abortion that would be covered by Medicaid, of course, a government-funded program, and it would also expand the times when state employees, therefore, again, right, also paid for by the taxpayer, could receive an abortion. There are limited instances now. The rest of it would basically lift this trigger, yeah, so that if the federal government changes Roe v. Wade, then Illinois could still keep abortions legal. But there isn't really any chance of that happening right now.
Yeah, there's no immediacy to this, especially when you're staring down the spring session. The final month is here. We all have hands on deck for a budget, which is 660 some odd days. I mean, it seems to me that what we're going to see more along the line, like in May, is going to be this political theater of trying to get the governor doing the same with Democrats to get on the record, because they're going to use that record to run against in 2018.
And I have to say that it does not give me much hope for chances of any sort of resolution when you already have so much going, looking forward to the 2018 election. I don't make predictions about what will happen, but nonetheless, when you already have all of the Democrats who are trying to take Rauner's job from him, out campaigning, raising money, down in Springfield, rallying cries, it is in Democrats' best interest to not give the governor a win and to continue for Illinois to not have any budget. And it also is far more difficult for the governor, as you noted earlier, conservatives don't like it, but in general, for it would be tough for a Republican to sign on to a tax increase, right, period. But when you have all of this breathing down your neck.
Amanda. So essentially,
happy Friday. Everybody take a shot.
there is no win for a politician on either side of the aisle right now to get a budget passed.
No.
There's no win. That's insane. Like, I mean, maybe you could work it out where you come out of this and you say, I was the one who brokered this. I'm the champion. But
well, that's where everybody has to hold hands, jump together. But it's all the more difficult because there is such a lack of trust. And it would also, I think, that's a responsibility. There's some culpability on the part of listeners to realize that and to try to look past the politics. It takes trust between Republicans, Democrats, but also between public and politicians that thus far haven't given one another really any good reason to have that trust.
I have to say I blame Governor Rauner for creating a trap for himself in this situation. This was something that by choosing to focus on these issues that are tangential to the budget and that may or may not have a huge impact on the economy. I mean, what needs to get done in this state is pretty clear, right? You have south suburbs that are paying property taxes at rates that are way out of whack compared to what they're getting in terms of the services, their school systems, et cetera. You've got to, and that's a situation that's extreme in the south suburbs, but it's bad everywhere around the state. And it's out, and it just doesn't really make sense. So you've got to have some sort of trade between property taxes and other kinds of taxes to take the burden off homeowners and put it into places where number one, it's more equitable, and number two, the money is there to actually be paid in a timely and productive way. So you've got to have that kind of restructuring. You probably need to redo the taxing structure in Illinois to come up with a progressive tax as opposed to what we have now, which is really a flat tax. Those really shouldn't be partisan issues. Likewise, looking at the pension system in Illinois and rooting out those same people that Amanda was just talking about that have ensconced themselves in state government and don't really do much work. That should also be something that shouldn't be a partisan issue. That really should be – these are all kind of good government things that could fall into the Republican or Democratic side. But Governor Rauner has put himself into a kind of, you know, particular kind of Republican.
He can't – that's the issue, though. He can't, Amanda. I mean, if he passes – if he balances a budget through a grand bargain, but it doesn't do the things that he had asked with the turnaround agenda, it doesn't change the way we fundamentally do government in the state of Illinois, it's a loss.
And that he maintains – I mean, first of all, it would be a loss because that's what he's spent all of these years demanding in exchange, and what would he get for that? But it also, to him, and there are a lot of people that agree with that, that would say that these are fundamental changes that Illinois needs. So yes, some of this should be bipartisan. I will say that that is not all put on Rauner. The progressive income tax is something that very much Democrats will push. Republicans do push back against that oftentimes because they say that that will lead to the wealthy people who can afford to leave Illinois will do so, either actually moving out of the state or at least moving the home that they declare themselves a resident of, and Illinois will miss that. So that is deeper. The property taxes question, it is pretty remarkable. You have calls for that statewide, Republicans, Democrats alike. It is, however, become part of this bigger conversation with the budget, as it needs to, because there are, again, calls from every corner of the state pretty much in terms of education funding, but nobody wants to give up. Even the, for example, suburban legislators who bemoan high property taxes also are going to say, hey, wait a second, an education funding bill that gives more money to the schools where their students, ours are getting $25,000 per kid and they're only getting $1,000. Wait, what?
Yeah.
It's so much deeper.
That's
I know
a transition.
You have to break,
No. But it makes a transition to winners, losers, because we can say, I mean, I'll speak for all of us. Winners and losers in this case are Democrats and Republicans. Everyone's a winner and a loser in the fight here. One of which we've seen this week, and we'll just touch on it before the news, is what's happening with CPS. The lawsuit, I mean, was really just sort of a Hail Mary by CPS and Forrest Claypool to essentially say that the system is racially discriminatory. The judge says, no, it's not. Get it out of the court. So now here we are in a sense where the CPS is short $200+ million. There has been rumors, which seems to be politically motivated as well, to say that they're going to shorten the school year. Rahm Emanuel came out today saying that's not going to happen. Instead of saying we'll come up with the money, he said we're going to force Rauner to do it. Like, it's a strange, like, so there's going to be this month of May of this political chicken between Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Rauner on who's going to make up the difference when it comes to Chicago public schools.
Well, and so there's that. I mean, to me, Chicago public schools did what perhaps it had to do, whatever the decision the board made, but to have thought that they were going to get this $215 million from the state was money they shouldn't have banked on in the first place.
Right.
Why they thought it was always tied to a pension bill passing and being signed into law. How the veto came about by Governor Bruce Rauner is, again, another deeper story unto itself. But point being, I'm not sure why, given that we haven't had a budget for, you know, two years.
Why would you count
think that was going to happen in the first place? And then these threats, it wasn't rumors. I mean, it was CPS saying, we are going to close school early. We will have no other choice but to do this. And now the mayor saying, no, that isn't going to happen. But without giving details, I think you're right. This is going to bring on a new stage of finger pointing in terms of the governor saying, hey, you've got TIF money. Use it. If you want CPS to stay open, go ahead and do that. And then the mayor already very much putting the blame on the governor for this.
Eitan, who wins? Who's going to win this fight?
Everybody loses, but Rahm Emanuel would have lost more if the schools had closed early. Rahm Emanuel would have been he's already, I think, on a very short leash on with Chicago voters, and that would have put people over the edge. I think that would have just especially if Rauner was then leveling the charge that there's money in city coffers that could have been spent on this, and the mayor chose not to use that money. The suffering that would have been put on parents, and you're a parent, you know how that goes. I'm a parent as well. CPS
it's unacceptable.
Parent.
Potentially
it's spikes
in violence with kids that don't have anywhere to go.
You're talking 3 weeks. I mean, that's it's unacceptable.
Yeah, that's you know, there's no the people with jobs, normal jobs, do not have the ability to find an extra 3 weeks to care for their children, and that's on the elementary school level. As Amanda said, on the high school level, you're talking about actual violence that could ensue as a result of
messing up seniors who are trying to graduate in college, and there's so much that goes into ending school early. That would be unprecedented.
Rahm would have not survived that situation, even if Rauner would have taken a blow there too. So the mayor really has no choice. He has to make sure that the schools close. Now he has to make sure they close on time, frankly.
I will say that there are two kind of side issues of this beyond the politics. Number one, we are soon going to be in May, that is the final month that the General Assembly is supposed to be in session. And right now, again, there is not only no budget for last year or this current fiscal year, FY17, but also this is the month when they're supposed to have one for the next fiscal year. In the past, schools have been protected. The governor says that education is his top priority, and he says one of his big accomplishments is he has successfully gotten more money into schools. Even when everything else is dying on the vine, that has happened. Will that happen again this year? Because one of the big thoughts, and there are some that are now sort of against it, this is really politically risky. I can't imagine a legislator really going along with it, but that would say we wouldn't have this impasse right now had schools been treated just like everybody else and had they not been the one area that was funded because people
wouldn't
put up with that.
And not so, unlike the state payments. I'm like, if you like what Lisa Madigan tried to do by with pushing the idea, because if they weren't getting paid, they would come to an agreement real quick. And the same with like if schools were not funded, they'd come to an agreement. I think you're absolutely right there. I think that they learned, they carved out all this stuff and they have let politics play out in the middle. And, you know, there's nothing we can do as taxpayers. There's nothing we can do but watch this sort of train wreck happen. But it's not at that code five level thing that we're used to reacting to.
Or at least for most people. There are some people for whom this is very much. They have lost their jobs. They are needing drug treatment and they can't get in.
Social service agencies are closing. But I know who wins as a result of this, by the way.
Yeah.
J.B. Pritzker and the Democratic candidates.
Anyone who's coming in, I can do something different. Eitan McKaylee, Amanda Vinicky. All right. We're having a great time here reloading this week's news. Let's take a break and get tonight's news. We'll come back. We will do. We got to do what sucked you down the rabbit hole. And of course, what story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from now? Sound good? Sounds good. It's Reloading the News here on The Download. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martyr. I've been engrossed in conversation about Springfield and all the other stuff, having a great conversation about the week that was. Uh-huh, I just took one of my eyes and I rotated it to the left to see the TV screen. And I was like,
it's not good. It's not.
What's happening?
Basically, what has happened at the United Center is that the massive ordnance air blast has gone off over the Chicago Bulls. And,
it's over.
And they're done.
I mean, it's a playoff game, right? This is not a game in February where no one wants to play. Mm-hmm. I thought the idea is that the big guys, they got up for the big playoff game.
Your big gun, Dwayne Wade, the off-season acquisition, has just 2 points.
Oh!
Yeah.
Wow!
I know. Jimmy Butler is doing his level best. He has 23.
2 points!
I know. 2 points and 19 minutes on the floor.
That is that was a short-lived career for the for playing for the Chicago Bulls. Thanks, Rob. It is The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9:30, Steve Dolinsky is going to be here, the Hungry Hound from ABC7, talk about the James Beard Awards, the Oscars of food. In town this weekend, all the chefs converging here on Chicago, the culinary mecca, if you will, the state of for this country. I mean, so much going on this weekend. Rick Bayless having his big party to celebrate 30 years of Frontera Grill. It's crazy. And, of course, the James Beard. So we'll talk with Steve Dolinsky coming up at 9:30. I won 2 James Beard Awards. I don't want to make a big deal about it. I bring it up
but
all
go time. Ahead.
When I would do the James Beard Awards, it was in New York. So this was 15, 20 years ago. And I got it for editing. And I had to rent a tux because I didn't have a tuxedo and it was all black tie. And I would rent it at Genghis up on Western. Like Western next to the Dominic's by the Roscoe Village kind of area there.
I remember that.
Yeah, there was a Genghis there, right? And the biggest, you know, the guy'd be like, do you want a cummerbund? I'm like, yeah, why not? You know, like, just had no concept. I'm 20 years old. I'm like, yeah, I'll take the cummerbund.
Do you not wear Is that even an option to wear a tux without a cummerbund?
I think you don't wear it if you're cool.
Oh.
Like if you wear a cummerbund, that's a bad... That, you're not going to the Marriott
Marquis. I don't go a lot of places where anybody is in a tux.
You're not going to the Marriott Marquis in Times Square with a cummerbund. That's just not a
I think it's a little 19th century.
Yeah. It's just a little prom.
Not right? Like, right. I was going to say, did you have a matching bow tie? Yeah, you got it in red with a...
No, I went for the cheapest possible. Like the $79 special, if probably cheaper at that point. Then I would take it on the plane, like, and I'd say, "Do you have a closet?" And they had it at the top of the they used to. I don't know if they still do it, where you could hang it up and you'd hang it up in there and be like, "Oh, great!" And I would go and stay on a friend's floor in New York, and I would go to the James Beard Awards.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was kind of awesome, and I wish I was much. I wish I knew what I knew now, because when I was there, I was like, "Huh." Like the whole weekend was like, huh? Like everywhere I went, I'm like, I don't know who any of these people are. Oh wow, Michael Caine's here. Like it's like that kind of thing. I'm like, that guy's in that movie.
I would have done my darndest to make friends and get myself invites to restaurants and dinner parties.
Yeah, that's
right?
What happens.
I mean, that's
absolutely.
Of course.
Did you eat? Did you?
Yeah, you eat. You do a ton of stuff, but it really truly.
Did you get your tux in a size bigger?
Honestly,
in preparation for the
event? I think one of the times I went, I like lost a shoe, you know, and I had to deal with Genghis when I got back. That's
deal with Genghis.
Anyway, me and Dolinsky at 9:30, we'll just talk all about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's in the meantime,
talking about going down a rabbit hole. I think this is the segue that I could go down quite the rabbit hole with anything regarding food at the James Beard Awards.
Right,
I'm more than willing to do that. And alas, I don't think I have any plans this weekend to partake in the festivities. I'm not winning an award
and don't have a meal ticket.
What
I would suggest,
but I'm ready and willing. Anyone,
just go ahead and put on a nice dress and just kind of circle around the nice restaurants. And
wait for somebody
another,
to take pity on
like,
me.
You can come in.
Who's this weird girl? What does she want?
Walk. Here's what you do. Ready? And then we'll get back to the weekend review. You walk into the restaurant, find out where the restaurant, and there's a party, and there'll be someone like, "Do your name?" And you just look past, and you look, and you go, "I'm looking for Chef. I don't see Chef. One second." And you go play a little bit on your phone, like you're trying to figure it out.
Right.
Come back up and say, "Is Chef?" And they'll let you in.
I just texted him. He's in there somewhere.
Chef blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Right. That was the one thing that I do remember.
My best friend, Stephanie. Yeah. Right.
I was in New York,
Girl
I
the
remember.
Goat? I'm a frequenter. Yeah.
I was very, very aware of not belonging. Right when I was there, because it's a very hoity-toity thing, especially in New York City. And
could spot your Genghis tux.
Exactly.
And
the night before, you wear a regular suit. And it was like my high school suit. So it's like, maybe like a little greenish. I was not in the right place, right?
Can I comment on your former employer's cheapness for not sending you, paying for a hotel room?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. But yeah, that's media, right? Yeah. So what I will say is that when I got there, I was like all worried. I'm like, because I went down there by myself. It was a party in the Trump Tower. And it was like in the restaurant, the chef's restaurant down there. And I was like so scared and nervous because I'm like, I'm going to walk in. They're going to be like, no way. Get out of here, right? You don't belong here. And I walked in, and I'm just kidding. I walk up to them, I'm like, Justin Kaufman, I'm here for the party. And they look past, and they're like, I don't see you on the list. And I'm like, I was about to walk out. Like, I was like, I wasn't even going to debate it. Like, I'm such a kid that I'm like, I'm gonna turn around and see if I can catch my friends before they go to the bar because I'm not supposed to be here. And as I turned the other way, there was another woman there. It's like, oh, yes, come on in. Like, I don't think I think she recognized the tension around it. And she recognized that I should have been on the list and I wasn't. And she, like, helped me out. But I wasn't on the list for this premiere party. And I got in. So I think there are opportunities for
Amanda. I'll pretend like pretend I'm like, deserving.
Yeah. There you go.
I feel bad for you that you were alone. Where were your fellow award winners?
They were already inside.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, all right.
Yeah. But thank you for your concern.
Bad for
20
this
years
poor
ago.
Little Justin.
Poor little.
A meek version of Justin Kaufman, which I can't quite 21 imagine. Year,
21 years old in New York City, like trying to get into the cool parties with my green suit from and my Genghis tux waiting at home.
Well, I want to know how you lost the shoe.
There's some things that are left better for just the story, right? I could go all night. All right, that's my rabbit hole. We are reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Amanda Vinicky, political reporter at WTTW. Eitan Michaeli, the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America from the Age of Pullman Porters to the Age of Obama. All right, let's talk about the story this week that sucked you down the rabbit hole. Mine was, of course, James Beard's. Eitan, what do you got?
Mike Flynn, the former National right. Security Advisor. It's just this strange and... stranger story. I don't know how else to describe it, that you have this guy who was apparently taking not small amounts of money from Russian television, other Russian sources while he was working on the Trump campaign. And even more bizarrely, while he was leading chants of lock her up about Hillary Clinton at Trump rallies. That's... just truly bizarre how he must have and he must have known he was doing illegal things because as it came out again this week, the Pentagon had warned him that he shouldn't be taking any foreign emoluments.
It's such an interesting story. And I heard that Roe had a great segment about it in the middle of the week that helped me figure it out. He essentially was going to Russia at that time. And this was even right before he was with the Trump campaign. And he was getting a hunt. I mean, $45,000, $50,000 to speak. And you're wondering what that money's for. And he wasn't reporting it. He was reporting that he was going to Russia because you have to with that kind of security clearance. But the real question is, a guy with that kind of security clearance, because at the time, whatever his role was, he was top security clearance for the United States
of
America.
He's a general in the United States military. That's,
and so you can't be taking money from unnamed sources and not reporting it because of what, you know, obviously what that could actually be for. And so he was saying he was going to Russia, but he wasn't telling them that he was getting paid. That's a no-no. That's going to end. They're probably going to land him in jail.
Well, and it's so strange that this comes out. This is not stuff that's that difficult to discover, right? If you get the money in cash, it's illegal to bring that kind of cash into the United States. That's a very serious crime. But if you transfer the money any other kind of way, that is money that the FBI is looking for.
Payments, it's traceable.
It's totally traceable. And payments from Russia are things that raise red flags for all sorts of law enforcement agencies in the United States.
So how does he not know that? He has to know that, right?
He did know because they told him. So even if he didn't know as a general in the United States military. So
do you think it's like, you know how some people are, this is a silly example, but I'm sorry, your story about James Beard as a 21-year-old is hearkening me back to younger days. And when Winona Ryder at her prime was caught shoplifting,
right.
And it's either some sort of like ego or call for help or some sort of, I mean, you know, I don't know.
It could be a consultant's
something
call for help.
Like that, where he either thinks that he is so above it all and smart and above board, even though not, I mean, like you said, even as he's saying lock her up, that he believes that he's in the right. I mean, I don't know. It's got to be, it's some sort of
he probably
mental
thought he would
health.
Never get caught. Like somehow he had worked it out. The question I have on this story, and we've gone back and forth and we've bantied this back and forth about what Russia's involvement was in the campaign for the Trump, for Donald Trump and the Trump administration. Does this get Trump off the hook in the way that it seems that they have sort of figured out that it's Flynn and the Russians, and maybe there wasn't anything deeper than just this weird sort of emolument?
Flynn is brought
failure?
Up on federal charges, if he gets indicted, Trump is going to be in serious trouble because this was his close advisor. This wasn't Carter Page, you know, the who's kind of a peripheral figure.
Right. Another guy who's been doing this stuff.
Yeah. A one-time advisor to listed one time as an advisor to Trump, never having met with Trump. That's something that's a little bit distanceable, right? Your national security advisor, the guy that was on stage with you time and time again, that's not someone
handpicked. I mean, not somebody who was just passed down from an administration. Hey,
this is
not
the guy
my fault.
Brought in to run the NSA.
Right.
This is serious, and I don't think that Trump will have a shortage of questions to answer on that. And that's something that won't go away. you know, at least through the trial and
you know, this is interesting because this is radio. Justin, when you first asked the question, you know, we're both here shaking our heads. No,
it's not
going to go away for Trump. Yeah. But at the same time, it is, again, 100 days in, it is still very early in the Trump administration. And yet, I think you saw, for example, with President Obama, some of his supporters losing patience pretty darn quickly when they didn't see action. And yet, and so you cannot predict how this will go forward. But everything about the Trump administration, everything that he does is just so unpredictable and will, however, a base that is typically a Republican base, conservatives that are very concerned about national security issues, nonetheless forgive him, because thus far, even with a whole lot of questions with Mike Flynn and otherwise about Trump's ties to Russia, has really pretty much given him a pass,
yeah.
as has the Republican Congress, or at least many Republican congressmen and congresswomen.
I think that changes if there's an actual indictment. I think if things get brought into the open in a legal sort of way, it's hard for people to resist the conclusion that there was something there that needs to be investigated.
Amanda, what do you got for stories that sucked you down the rabbit hole this week?
I would say I was quite busy working, so I'm not sure how many rabbit holes I got to
There's
go down. It was not an Alice in Wonderland sort of week for me. But I would say it was interesting. So on, what was it, Tuesday, there was a women's march in Springfield.
Right.
And while the abortion bill was the focus, there were other women sort of issues that came up throughout the week, including the Equal Rights Amendment. And that kind of sucked me down a rabbit hole. I was not around in the 70s when this first came about, but I, you know, I just had the opportunity to talk with some women, some of whom were there when this was first a major issue, and hearing some of the stories about the fight there, memories of Phyllis Schlafly, who passed away, was it this year or maybe just last year?
Last year, right?
Some of the stories about that fight, and then really people coming to Springfield and to Illinois from throughout the nation to fight for the Equal Rights Amendment, and even why it failed then and why it's back now. So that was a, sort of a rabbit hole through history for me this
week.
You
know, you also covered the higher ed protest as well on Thursday, which I thought got very little coverage. I mean, I was going to put that up for underreported in the way that it's just, you know, I feel like I missed it completely because other stories
that
were happening.
It was not a huge rally, I would say, and not to say that the number of people who come down to Springfield is an indicator of how important an issue is, because higher education in Illinois is in a big crisis. I mean, that is perhaps underreported in terms of just how devastating that is. To me, the underreported aspect of that, because there's been a lot of attention given to these MAP grants that go to low-income students and help them go to school. There has been attention given recently to Northeastern University having to close down for days. There's been some attention, less so lately, but to Chicago State University and its leadership changes and its having to last year cancel spring break so that they could finish on time. I mean, all of that. But to me, it's also when you look at some of the state schools, the directional campuses, Western, Eastern, as they are having to lay off professors and seeing fewer students, that is not just decimating to Illinois, where you're losing students that may not ever come back, but it is also to these small towns where that is the only game in town. Chicago will thrive. I'm not saying I hope any IU or CSU closes, but Chicago will be fine without it.
Macomb, Charleston
will not be. And that is going to be for years, for decades to come, if something like that happens.
And this is the economy of the state of Illinois. In my slightly less than glamorous book tour, I've been able to go to many smaller towns around the United States. And when you go to places like Pittsburgh or Louisville, the universities and the medical centers, that is what's driving the economy of those places. And you can see that any kind of revitalization in these formerly industrial towns is coming out of the nexus of those two worlds, right? It's high tech meets the medical industry. It's something that you can't do in Silicon Valley because the research is being done in Louisville. That's the kind of thing that you need to have happening in Illinois. If you don't have medical research being done at that level, you're losing out as a state. We are in a very backwards situation as a state right now, where we're not investing in our universities. Even deep red states are pouring money into their schools, as into their health systems, because of that reality. So it's we're eating our seed corn.
All right, let's finish up tonight. We'll do a real quick round robin on what story you think will be remembered from this week in 5 years, in a month, in 500 years, when they're going to write on, we're going to be in caves. We're going to look and there's going to be a cave drawing of a story from this week. What would you think it is, Eitan?
Well, last time I was on your show, I predicted that if Trump was elected president, that it would be the same thing as I like to read, like, ancient histories. And so it would be the same. Like, I remember reading somewhere in the history of the Byzantine Empire that at one point the Praetorian Guard decided to elect one of their buddies as emperor. And Hugo, I think his name was a disastrous emperor. The empire lost 2/3 of its territory, half the population converted to Islam, and Constantinople was besieged by the Turks. So I predicted that Trump's election would be that kind of a moment. But having seen the first...
That was a pretty good prediction. I mean,
right.
Well, I'm not sure now, after 100 days, that the Praetorian Guard isn't kind of looking at their choice and wondering if it's not time to, you know...
Get another buddy in there.
Think about a President Pence or something like that, you know? I don't see that... As weak as the institutions of the United States are, I detect a little bit of resistance in some parts.
Amanda, what do you got?
I really hope that we're not talking about any of this mess in 500 years. I do think that the state budget situation and what is going on with Chicago and CPS is bad enough that it will be talked about. The ramifications will be felt for 5-450, unfortunately. I will say that the Illinois House today did pass a bill that makes corn the state grain. We already have sweet corn as the state vegetable, so that may stick with us for decades to come.
Everybody? And I'll say Mitchell Trubisky. I will say that the Chicago Bears picked a franchise quarterback, the first time ever that they had a number one, number two pick. Last time they had the top three pick was the 60s or 70s or something like that. But the idea that they went in on a franchise quarterback, that kid should be in Chicago for at least 10 years, if not 15, hopefully 20.
He already made an appearance at the Chicago Bulls game tonight, which makes me a fan. Yeah, way to show some hometown pride already. Adapt that quick.
The Bulls did lose by double digits.
That's not his fault. We can't put that on his quarterback yet. Get it? Ha ha. That was rough, but I said it. Sorry.
Amanda Binicky, Eitan McKaylee, my guests tonight as we reloaded this week's news. You guys, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.